Okay.
This is about the work in progress I'm doing with Fritz Mastner at the University of Toronto. Since this work in progress is probably going to be quick. So what's this about? It's about corpuscular outflows across stellar mass, which I mean I want to consider corpuscular outflows from low mass stars, from high mass stars.
Of course, the ambient around a low mass star is different from the ambient around a high mass star. We can expect.
So we have to cover the possibilities and the parameter space.
And the parameter space has at least the following ingredients. You have to describe the protostar, the wind, it has some mass loss, some velocity, some magnetization, and the ambient medium, which I can describe as a mass density as a function of position. And because as an abstraction, I'll assume the ambient medium is initially at rest, which probably is reasonable compared to expected quite fast velocities on the wind. Okay. Well, all these ingredients, in fact, do have some correlations. And I can parameterize correlations either with the final stellar mass or with the core luminosity, which is often an easier quantity to measure, so it will kind of go in place of the final stellar mass. Okay, those ingredients have to be mixed, and the basic recipe is, of course, shooting the wind into the ambient medium. Okay, that makes a shell made of shock wind and shock ambient material. Okay, if with some radiative cooling, well, the shell can become quite thin. In an extreme case, by the way, the shock ambient always cools quickly, so that shell is thin. But the shock wind might make a very thin shell for radiative bubble, very efficient cooling. That is essentially momentum conserving. You have the extreme slow cooling case, essentially adiabatic. It's an energy conserving, makes very thick shells. You have intermediate case, partial radiative bubbles, medium thick. The wind runs a little faster than momentum conserving shell, but it still loses quite a bit of energy. This is already well-known material. It works on 1D models. And the 2 and 3D simulations we have been doing don't destroy this model, but add some quirks and some extra information to it. For instance, I'll announce in advance, you can get a situation when in a bubble that is kind of radiative, the axis can produce a cocoon that will cover the rest of the jet and make a kind of pseudo a thick shell around it made of material that came initially from the axis. It's an effect of collimation. Okay. Before going to do the simulations, we say we needed to get a good idea of the parameter space. So we can start by the ambient medium, which is something that has been talked quite a bit about here. I'm sure that some of the people more familiar with observations will have things to say about this. We start with a parametrization that at some distance scale is valid. I'm caring about the subparsec scale. So I parameterize by rho r18. Assume I have a power law. Okay, I need to go from low to high stellar mass, so let's start from the low. There, we use this data from the Perseus molecular cloud, the little fitting on certain of the codes. and the area around them, making plots of mean column profile around each peak, trying to find a kind of approximate power law distribution. And we get quite a recent power law distribution, which sigma goes like radius to the minus 0.5. So we get that rho goes like r to the minus 1.5, which is kind of a traditional power law in this business, quite close to some other observed objects. For a high basset, we start from a survey by Müller et al. That survey uses a millimeter emission to probe a range of radii up to, in the order of magnitude we care about, around massive protostars. It's for a substantial fraction of the sample, we could find enough data to calculate our famous ρ18, which, as you can see, doesn't have. Has some dispersion, of course, around the kind of median value, 5.6 10 to minus 20 grams per cubic centimeter, obtained at this median luminosity, more or less. But the dispersion is not huge. And if I say that this has a dependence with luminosity, it's slowly rising, it's kind of flat. So we have now two data points for our scaling of the medium. Having two points, we tie them together, and we estimate then that the typical density scale will be calculated this way. Okay, obviously there is a minus sign here. Okay. So you can see that the dependence on luminosity is kind of flat, but given that the luminosity range is easily 6 or 7 orders of magnitude, it will accumulate to something from the low to a high mass end, which fits with the slow rise we saw in the sample at the high mass star formation. Now we'll say, yes, they really fit. You remember yesterday in Van der Tak talk, he showed data from this particular object, showed that this was the luminosity, get data that can be translated into ρ18 this way. It was 4.0, 10 to minus 20. Well, if you use our little formula, get 4.6. Really fits. Fits more than we have the right to expect, of course, because as we've seen in the real high mass sample, okay, we can easily have dispersion from high to low of maybe one order of magnitude. Evidently, the object we are talking about here is an object kind of on the middle of the dispersion, which is maybe not surprising, will be the most typical. Okay, so now we have to continue our search for our preferred parameters. Let's go now for the index. And let's say at the end we are going to go for 1.5. First, we have that in the data from Perseus, it's 1.5. For high star formation, we read the literature. We have the one that we just talked about, Van der Tak 1999. He reports also for that object, 1.5. The Müller et al. Sample we used reports a substantially larger median value, but the range easily includes 1.5. Here you have, in fact, the sample. Maybe it's probably better to see here. Yes, again, I think 1.5 is still a typical value. 1.7 may be a little thicker on the ground, but 1.5 is still quite in the good side. Okay. So we have other sources giving similar values, so in that even if perhaps one prefers it's a little on the low side of it, we agree with McKenta and review that 1.5 is good to do theory and simulations with. You could argue that this data would imply some tendency to increase the value of K with luminosity, but it's not really conclusive, say Parsons theory. So, now let's go to parameterize the star. First thing is to link the mass with the luminosity. And we are going to use this simple power law. At the high mass end, it's a very firm connection. It's simply hydrogen burning. With a little extra help from accretion, we'll give you this. It's a very strict thing. The low mass end of this is not so well defined because you have to assume some things about the accretion rate. But these values are around, say, 100 solar luminosities are consistent with the calculations from Palin-Stoller. If you plug in 0.2 solar masses, you'll get a luminosity of 7 solar luminosities, which is consistent with what you expect from class 0 protostars. So I will say even on the low mass end, this can be indicative, even if not so strictly and almost a measurement as you will be on the high mass end.
Sorry, this is the
bolometric
luminosity?
Yes, it's the bolometric luminosity. Linking the bolometric luminosity of the core to the final mass the star will have on arrival to main sequence.
You said of the core, where is the star?
Well, in this case, definitely the star itself is dominating.
You see it when you measure the core luminosity.
Yep.
You assume it's totally
dominating. In the high mass end, it will be dominated by that. Not so on the low mass end. The low mass end, far from that, that will be a relatively small contribution. Most will come from accretion, or in some intermediate mass range, it will come from deuterium burning.
But isn't the accretion luminosity highly time-dependent? So in what sense is it just one number?
Let's say that our purpose here is to set typical values rather than absolute values. So it will be some kind of a typical value around the middle of the building of the star, rather than a unique value, as you point out. Yep, it is time-dependent. Okay, so we need also, in addition to an estimate of the mass, Plakias that can be on the low mass end, we need also an accretion rate. We take it from McKeon-Tan model, turbulent plus thermal. The turbulent part will be based on a density profile that will be the density profile we already found. This one. But we'll assume that we'll be supported by turbulence. We assume there will be also a central thermally supported core with a temperature around, say, 15 to 20 Kelvin. So you can get a total accretion rate will be dominated by the turbulent part for high mass and dominated by the thermal core for low mass. This accretion rate can be mapped into a formation time, and the formation time we get is plausible. We get values from 7 × 10⁴ to 4 × 10⁵ years, which is kind of the expected range for formation stars. Okay, so next step is to talk about the wind. If we are going to talk about the outflows and how we pinch the medium, definitely the wind itself is probably the most important ingredient. Well, the most obvious effect of the wind is injection of momentum. Velocity of wind times and that. We are going to use the data fit of Wu et al. 2004, which construct this fit for the force as a function of luminosity. In that fit, it's obviously much larger than the radiation momentum, kind of obvious, but it's good to see, even the obvious working okay, over three orders of magnitude difference. Okay, so we adopt this force and we'll round it up to 328 dynes with a dependence of luminosity that we round the 0.648 to 2/3. Okay. If we were talking about a purely radiative model, this will be enough, because being momentum conserving, knowing the momentum injection rate will be all what we need. But we plan to include some cooling in the model, and so we need to know also the velocity and the mass loss rate of the wind. So we have an estimate for the product, we need an estimate for each factor. Well, okay, let's start from jet launching theory. Theory tells us the velocity will be the order of magnitude of the depth of the gravity potential well, the escape speed, essentially. Here you have some simulations of jet launching. Here you can map the velocity on the inner disk to the velocity on the outflow. Observe how the velocity and outflow, at least in this particular simulation, doesn't have a huge theta dependence. And it's on the order of, say, one times I have the Keplerian velocity of the inner disk is launching the jet. And there we could either assume the Frank Schuster wind model and say, okay, that Keplerian velocity is going to be essentially the same as the Keplerian velocity on a stellar surface. Or even without going so far as to admit that model fully, we have to admit that at least it will be connected by some reasonable factor. And so we adopt for the velocity of the wind, say 10% more than the escape speed from the surface of the star. Okay, so we can couple estimates for the mass and radius of the protostar.
So I agree, I think Frank would be happy with those numbers, but my impression is that Ralph has argued that for disk winds you actually get substantially larger values.
Substantially larger values for the ratios or for the ratio? That you can get far more efficient acceleration.
My understanding is he's arguing that, whereas Frank would say that you get roughly 1/3 of the mass is going in and get thrown out at this velocity, Ralph would argue that you have a larger moment arm with the magnetic field and you have less mass going out, maybe only 10%. Going out, and it's going several times.
Which is a natural distinction between a disk wind model and an X-wind model. I believe the truth is kind of in between both, that they both the extreme X-wind picture and the extreme disk wind picture are kind of equally wrong, that the truth is almost exactly a geometric mean between both. So let's square root whatever extra factor was Ralph believes in. And so this value might end up being kind of conservative. The velocities can well be substantially larger.
But if coming from a larger radius away from the star, so the V cap is lower. So it kind of mitigates that a little bit.
Ah, oh, a little bit.
It comes from a range, right?
Yeah, so no.
Which velocity are we considering?
True. No, I think it's true. Ultimately, the main engine is the gravity potential well. So even if the disk wind is more extended, the ultimate velocity will be connected to the depth of the well onto a star. you could argue some things against it, by the way. It's not so clear-cut.
Why are you saying that you are convinced that the truth is in between?
I mean, because...
It may be in between, but how do you know?
No, no, okay, I can tell. Because there are a few observations on the rotation of the jet itself. And those values can be used to give an estimate of the location of the foot point.
Don't believe the rotation of the jet.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's
be
a good...
Careful.
We weren't careful.
Okay, good.
We did trust the values, even as you point out, they're not so trustworthy. And what we got after trusting some values like that is a factor of 4 between the inner and the outer radius of the effectively launching disk. The real disk is much larger, but if part is effectively launching material, if we trust those values of rotation, that, as Hans points out, are not so trustworthy after all. They're quite contaminated by other complex interactions between the jet and the ambient medium. And that's the easy part of it. There are other issues involved. For instance, we are trying to measure the rotation of a jet that is moving at a very high velocity compared to its relatively slow rotation speed. Even a relatively small error in estimate of the axis direction could contaminate the rotation speed with a projection from the outflowing speed. As I said, recognizing those problems, we used the estimates of rotational data and got a value of 4, which is my reason to believe these days that both the extreme X-wing picture and extreme disk-wing picture are both exaggerations. Okay, but even we can consider this as either an adoption that assumes the X-wing model to be true, or, as pointed out here, we don't even need to assume the X-wing model. Even on the disk-wing model, the Keplerian speed will now not be the Keplerian speed of the star. Will be the Keplerian speed farther away. We might end up matching anyway the velocity of escape with which, through an extra factor of acceleration, more efficient acceleration because of a larger Lieberman ratio, we'll end up anyway matching the escape speed at the surface of the star. Okay, so assuming this, we can then estimate the velocity of escape on the surface of the star at an extra 10% for luck. And so you obtain velocities in the order of 100 to 1,000 km per second. Over the range, going from 10 solar luminosities to, say, a million. Okay, so shape we got is a kind of broken power law, where here we get something like 150 kilometers per second for our low mass stellar wind, and we get things in the order of 1500 to 2000 on the high mass end, with a transition luminosity around 10 to 4 or so. This region of the curve, by the way, might, if we were to trace it more carefully, will have an extra wiggle due to the presence of the deuterium burning region. But you could put to doubt how much that would affect the launch of the wind.
So can you remind me what mass is that will fall
so long? What will be the corresponding mass? Oh, let's go to a little formula. So it will be square root of, it will be around 8. So it will be kind of not far from the deuterium burning region.
18.
No,
not from this one. You're saying
10 to the 4?
10 to the 4 divided by 5 square root. So 25 by 3, it's around 8-ish.
I think I thought about 8-10.
Mm-hmm. Which shows by which it's not a bad estimate for the correlation in this case. The formula is still on the okay side of it. Okay. So we got an estimate for the velocity, which can be criticized due to the some disputes on jet launching theory, as we went through. But we have double checks here. This is not our only handle on wind velocity. Have another one. Because we have the force, we can divide up then the mass loss rate, and then divide the mass loss rate by the estimate we got for the accretion. So wind mass loss divided by the accretion rate, well, and we get a value that goes between 0.1 and 0.2. It's very well into expected range. So as long as you believe this kind of ratio, this could have, if you have wished, even traced a line around here and probably and got probably a very similar estimate for the wind velocity. There is some, let's go on to the simulations a little now. We don't have too much in the terms of simulations I fully trust. One reason is that we had started simulations before finishing doing this, what we could call fiducial line for protostellar outflows. So many of simulations will fall a little outside of our curve. Okay, the first one is in our curve. And let's show the little movie. Okay, here you have, this is a logarithm of density. You can see the shape of the collimated part of the shell, the uncollimated one. It's MHD. It's MHD with a relatively weak magnetic field, at least at the base. At the base it was Alphanic Mach number 20. The parameters correspond to a low mass star, as we were discussing, around a luminosity around 30.
Do you follow the acceleration of the wind, or you just prescribe m dot and v min as at that value?
I prescribe it at a small inner radius. And the density profile is the usual density profile for jet launching is the 1/sine² θ. That has to be smooth close to the axis because otherwise it would diverge here. But how much to smooth it? Okay, that is kind of an estimated how much is good, how well collimated was the jet before it hit the medium. For the purpose of simulation, we work with around 4 to 5 degrees, which is almost surely on the thick side of it. The real collimation is better.
Something like that.
So there is outflow in all directions, not only on the little cone. There is outflow also in the equatorial direction, but you can see on the equator it almost doesn't move compared to the axis. Of course, even if the velocity of the wind is independent of angle, I'm injecting so much more momentum here, so of course this goes much faster. But you can see that even the equatorial region is expanding, even slowly. The magnetic field, what the magnetic field does is subtle. I'll show later, but essentially it's helping to push forward a little.
What's the geometry? Is it only toroidal?
Only toroidal. Only toroidal, and that might be a serious limitation of the simulation. The poloidal fields could make very interesting effects, such as stabilizing the axis.
Axis symmetry, yeah? Oh,
Is this an axisymmetric simulation? Yes, this is a 2D axisymmetric simulation. I have a few 3D simulations too, but I have not shown them today.
You said your geometry, like the way you plotted it, doesn't seem to be a right angle.
Excuse me?
It feels like this. It's around here.
This is the axis of symmetry, and also the axis of the jet. This is the equator.
Which axis? The one where the jet is?
This is the axis of symmetry.
Is it the very left side of the plot, or is it right in the center where it looks like there's a jet there?
The axis of symmetry where it looks like it's a jet there.
Okay, so where there's a jet.
I'm showing a little of the other side too, let's say. Yeah, I'm showing the first handful of zones on the other side. There is no accretion disk because it will correspond to a spatial scale much smaller than any of the scales of interest here.
And no angular velocity either?
Angular velocity, no angular velocity either.
And this is
If I put angular velocity, it will automatically start generating a poloidal field, and I don't. This the code being used is my own version of Zeus.
The logarithmic in radius and fixed in angle.
Yeah, kind of. In fact, it's not. It's kind of logarithmic in radius, but on this direction, it's not uniform. I'm increasing resolution close to the axis, where everything interesting really happening.
10 minutes.
Okay, let's show briefly a movie on another simulation that is also Luma star but doesn't fit the curve so well. They show what's the toroidal field doing, just as people talk about the field. It's not doing anything essentially very different, but you can see some. Later you'll see probably some interesting features. You see here the place where the spherical wind essentially is touching the collimated wind, there will be some structure generated. Perhaps more clearly seen on the.
This is just dragging.
Essentially, yes. It's essentially being adverted. Of course, the field itself is active. It helps to push and helps to collimate to some extent. Here is probably more clear what I was trying to see. Here you can see some generation of vorticity structures, what you could call maybe the neck of the jet. By now, the tip of the jet has already left the computational box. It's just in back. Here you can see.
Is this in the intermediate cooling regime?
Yes, it is. In fact, almost all the simulations I do end up, like it or not, in the intermediate cooling regime. Apparently, it's typical. Okay. So much about nice movies, and so let's go and answer what a magnetic field is doing. This is another set of simulations, also on the Luma starish case. These are even farther away from the fiducial line, but still representative. Okay, so we have here unmagnetized winds with three thermodynamics, isothermal, cooling, and adiabatic. Here you can see almost nothing interesting happens. Simply push things conserving momentum. If you add magnetic field, you add an extra tip made, obviously, by magnetic field helping to push the jet out. If you don't go so far as isothermal, put a more realistic cooling law, our power law, cooling law, you can see that while the location of the shell is still essentially given by momentum conservation, the shape of the shell is altered by instabilities. Probably this is a version of the Vishnik instability, but I'm not completely sure. I didn't check if this is that one yet. If you add a magnetic field, you change qualitatively the situation. You get the magnetic field manages to stabilize this instability. I believe that's because the magnetic field is the kind of pressure you cannot cool. So in some sense, the magnetic field is behaving like here. It's something you cannot cool, really.
The shell that's breaking up is the compressed ambient.
This one?
No, the part that's the middle top.
Middle top. This one?
Well, just the whole panel, but the part that's turbulent. It seems like the red color, right? The highest density.
Let's say at this stage there is the instability is causing entrainment. It might start to become difficult to see which is a shocked ambient and what's a shocked wind.
The fact that the magnetic field stabilizes it implies that the instability is being caused by post-shock wind gas as opposed to ambient gas, because the ambient gas is not magnetized. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Ambient gas is completely magnetized. One interesting feature here is the presence of a little bullet, you could call, of material here. I believe that if you pay lots of attention, you can see a tiny bullet being shot here, too. These things are probably due to oblique shocks being generated and converging. At first, I thought that's artificial, converging oblique shock onto the axis and then shooting is bind to, believing your axisymmetry too much. But once I saw that kind of effect can happen also here, start to believe it can be to some extent physical. It's exaggerated by axisymmetry here, but still to some extent physical.
But it's not nearly as far.
Not nearly as far.
I think I would still be skeptical.
About this one, not skeptical, unbeliever, but the fact that there is a process allowing this kind of bullets to be appear. In fact, I did once I did a 3D simulation of this, and it was still there.
Even the other one?
Not so intense, but it was still there, and clearly more intense than the other ones, even on a 3D hydro simulation.
3D Cartesian?
3D Cartesian. No, not 3D spherical.
So you still have an axis?
Yes, but the axis is not the axis of symmetry, you see. It's 3D spherical with the axis of symmetry away from the axis of the jet, on purpose, to avoid that kind of criticism. Yeah. In fact, I put the axis of symmetry of the numerics on the equator, where you could do the least harm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I could mention briefly the adiabatic simulations, but they are probably too far away from the real physics to matter unless at a cold training. Okay, so I already mentioned what I wanted to mention, magnetism, the instabilities, and the bullets. Okay, so maybe I have to cover that 5 minutes for my summary, or perhaps earlier to go for beer, don't know. Okay, so what is the point of this? As I was saying, it's doing a survey of parameter space for protostellar outflows. A survey in which the ambient medium, the star, the wind, and cooling are accounted for in an approximate way. It's not the intention to be close enough to represent individual objects correctly, but in a self-consistent manner, and that is tight observational data. So the objects we are going to simulate are typical objects for each mass range. There will be objects that will be, say, will have an unusually fast wind, objects that have a wind with an unusually slow momentum injection. We're going for the typical in the survey. Okay. And we have already some results. The typical wind tends to be light, and it is partially radiative. The axial region of the wind made it relatively heavier, but probably not even enough to make it even the axial region heavy. We are shooting a light wind of low density into heavier density medium, and that seems to be quite universal. Okay, so it is partial radiated. There is some theory about partial radiated bubbles, such as in Koo and McKean paper. And then inequalities that asymptotic theory depends on I'm saying even too weak, are not always completely fulfilled. I haven't yet seen a case where they are fulfilled. And so the situation tends to be that the location of the tip of the jet is not so badly predicted by momentum conserving theory. But the shape of the shell is quite different. While explore in more detail the high mass limit with simulations, we might have to review this. This is the current situation.
Does it mean that the wind is not as good at training or as a feedback mechanism, or does it mean that at all? Interpreting this.
Well, you inject more energy when you're farther away from being radiated. You inject more energy, the least efficient your cooling is. So it might be different for the low mass end and the high mass end, let's say. It might even depend on issues having to do with a possibility the tip of the jet might start to accelerate and perhaps going to relative instabilities. So we did see cooling-related instabilities. Those cooling-related instabilities, you argue, would reduce the feedback effect through entrainment. In general, instabilities will tend to mix ambient and wind, will tend to enhance cooling. Almost any kind of instability I mentioned right now will tend to enhance cooling and make the system effectively more radiative. So we did observe the bullets. It could be interesting to see if these bullets have anything to do with any observed feature. Honestly, I do not know for sure. They persist in 3D, as I said. They are probably caused by oblique shocks at the edge of the shell. And the presence of oblique shocks already tells you are not in the fully radiated regime. In the fully radiated regime, you simply plunge in. You don't get oblique shocks, really. Magnetism creates some effects. As I said, well, the most obvious, it's an extra force. The shell will pull in faster. It can suppress some of the instabilities, and such it could enhance the feedback. We see some generation of vortices. And here a technical point, it could be that the wind could become subalvanic. In that case, it is possible, I'm not completely sure it's physical process or a numerical defect yet, there could be some inward motion of the wind shock. What I mean by that? Okay, here you have the ambient shock, the wind shock. It could happen in some circumstances the wind shock will move into. That happens in situations where the wind is locally subalvanic. You can get magnetic pressure pushing in. I have the strong suspicion that is not unphysical, but not astrophysical. Let's say I don't think in real astrophysics the conditions for that will be done. But the simulations allow it because that possibility is not physically impossible. But I don't think it's really happening, and that is one of the many reasons this is still work in progress. One of the questions I want to answer to myself before publishing is knowing more about this. Okay, so I think I covered it all. Let's go to the main point. Serving parameter space and shooting outflows into a medium.
So people might be eager to move on to the next stage.
I'm sure, and someone is crazy enough to ask questions.
I have a question. I think this is nice, but does it really capture all the physics?
No, it doesn't.
So.
It captures a large part of the physics, but not all.
For example, radiative-driven winds and ionized winds.
Okay, but would you believe that that is very important? You see this curve. Radiation momentum is much smaller than the momentum observed on the wind, observed on the shell. So, thank you, 1 point. I was just thinking today, maybe you can get some element of radiation, radiatively driven winds in this part, the equatorial part, if not on the tip of the jet. Maybe this region in reality is pushed farther away due to radiation pressure. That I would consider possible. Not here. Here, I believe it's completely limited by the force you're putting in.
But if you consider the sort of the anisotropic radiation field, the flashlight effect, then I think radiative driven winds will be important.
Okay.
The total momentum observed in the jet is higher than L over C. So wherever you beam it,
But it could be in some particular direction, it happens to be important. In particular direction where the momentum of the jet is relatively important, like here. Even then, you have to go over three orders of magnitude. But we can believe it's very, the jet can be very strongly collimated.
It doesn't matter whether it's collimated or not, it's a global, they measure the global momentum and the global luminosity, whichever direction it's going to be.
Right, so overall for the wind, it can't be
powered ultimately by for higher mass stars, I think it certainly can be.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, for much higher.
No.
You remember, for instance, the so-called fiducial radius that appears in some of the theories. It so happens that the power law 1.5 is such that fiducial radius becomes weird. It easily becomes a few Hubble lengths. Well, it's another way of saying it. It's very often it's a very light length.
I'm still not convinced. I mean, for example, these observations at the high mass end. I mean, this is often is not one star. This is a number. It's a small cluster, and so and also not.
You're saying a particular individual star might be.
The observations that you have up there. This is tricky.
Let's say this. Let's look to this object. Maybe for this object I will buy it. Even if not for the typical object. And maybe, as you point out, this object might be more than one star. It might be a small clump.
It needs to be 100 stars.
A cluster. Maybe one object inside a clump or cluster might even go beyond the edge.
I think the real question is whether the winds at the highest masses are the same type of winds. Then this whole argument of scaling low mass star formation to the higher masses, and this is crucial. I mean, with the outflows, how to interpret that, and I'm not sure.
But I don't think that. I think that's sort of outside the scope of this model anyway.
That's right.
It's just prescribed to the wind.
Yeah, yeah, but
as long as you believe that the velocity of this wind. He's looking at the interaction with the.
But we forget later on what the scope of the model was. That's important to remember assumptions.
So, another effect that perhaps I will consider more directly related to the model than I took into account is the fact that limiting myself to the toroidal magnetic field makes me lose very important physics. Colloidal fields can change the stability properties of the field. That is more kind of more inside the scope of what
you can feel. Also the ambient field that you don't have.
Well, that, yeah, that's true. Another one.
There is an ambient field.
There is, and I'm not taking that into account. That's another big limitation.
But you could easily move
that. Well, yeah, it will be no problem. Well, it will be expanded parameter space, let's say. But apart from that, yeah, will not, apart from the expansion of parameter space, numerically just as same effort as any other thing.
And what if the wind has to go through a pretzel?
Okay. Let's consider on the surface of the glass of beer, a bubble goes and breaks, and will create oblique shocks on the surface. Will that create a little bubble, a little bullet? In fact, it does. It does. It's a kind of thing.
Okay, let's thank everybody again.